Okay. I'm actually going to move into the next section, which is sort of the project midpoint on the staffing side for production and depositions. And the key facts here is the team is now more comfortable and liking grade school. Cliques have emerged. There's a sense of who you need to impress or befriend to get promoted. With no terminations, there's a looseness about cigarette and coffee breaks. There's lots of internet surfing, and one coder's writing and posting a blog in between coding documents, which was only learned based on the substantial typing this coder was doing much more than everyone else. The leadership's found more errors and are unsure if they should go back and review some documents in the worst coders. Some of the coders were French-speaking and also IP attorneys because the fourth C's French office and the technical nature of reviewing the ingredients. These coders were paid a premium rate, but now they're coding more normal documents, and most of them seem to code slower than the average coder who are paid less money, so there's some tension over this. Tess, how do you deal with office politics on a project when it comes to promotions?
Well, I mean, first let me say that there's nothing unique about a group of contract attorneys reviewing documents that causes political issues. I think you put a group of any, you know, large number of people together, and cliques are going to form, and you're going to see this sort of behavior. How do you try to avoid it? At least what we try to do is be very clear up front on what our expectations are of our team, as far as internet surfing and other outside activities. We also are very transparent about how one gets promoted within our group. It's based upon merit. It's interesting in any group of people, and again, I don't think this is something peculiar to contract attorneys. Leaders will make themselves stand out just by their the quality of the work that they do and their level of engagement and so forth. And what we try to do is, in addition to identifying those folks and promoting them, also making the rest of the team aware that there's room for everyone. You don't have to be a leader to stay engaged and to be a value to the entire team. So.
Okay. Tim, does managing the team become easier as the project goes on?
Well, I think as a general principle, it does, as you know, almost any project would be once you have your feet wet and you resolve the issues that have come up, things get easier to manage. Two issues that you need to think about that come up as the project goes on are potential complacency and boredom from repetition among team members. If you have a project that's going on for months or even years in some large litigations, those can crop up. And those are the types of things that the team management has to pay attention to through all the techniques that everybody has discussed already today. Meetings and interaction with the team members, emphasizing to them the important function that they're performing on behalf of the client.
Dave, how do you handle wage differences between different specialty groups on a project, or is there no simple answer to this?
Well, I don't think the answer is very simple because notwithstanding that employees will talk to each other about how much they're making, that's usually information that you can't disclose, so you can't address the issue directly. I think you have to address the issue indirectly by letting the team know how valuable different people are. Your example of somebody that speaks a foreign language, when you're running into documents in that foreign language, that skill can be invaluable. And I think comments that you can make to the team can let everybody know that all of the employees are valued and that some of the special skills that some of the employees bring to the project are especially essential. And then that may help them deal with their private knowledge that they might not be making as much as the person sitting next to them who can speak two or three foreign languages, for example.
Okay, I'm going to move into the last section, which is project trial with the technology people. The law firm in this situation wanted to use a package called Trial Director as their trial software, but we at 4C insisted that Startup be used because it was part of Startup's package. With some trepidation, the firm agreed. When it came time to produce an exhibit list for trial, it turned out that the software did not enable local printing. In addition, our law firm wants all the exhibits to be printed for trial preparation because they'd rather have paper to prepare for trial. Mr. Opsitnik, what's your reaction to a software product which can be used as both a document searching tool for electronic discovery, document storage tool, and also a trial package?
I think it's great if it can do that, but you've got to keep the the end in mind, and this is about winning a case. And the last thing you want to do, that a litigator wants to learn in or do in the middle of a trying or preparing for the case is learn to use a new software product. I don't think you should attempt to teach an old dog new tricks in the middle of the show, and I would avoid the argument and let them use the software that they're comfortable with.
Okay. Chris, is it a good idea to convert electronic documents to paper when preparing for trial?
I don't recommend it. A good trial support tech will carry more than one laptop, typically for redundancy purposes, and impeaching witnesses because of unexpected testimonies. It's a lot easier when you have documents in electronic format that are properly coded, OCR'd, and easier to find. Additionally, you can take a portable printer with you if hard copies needed.
Okay. Tom, do you see unplanned issues occur with software trials, such as the problem in the 4C example with preparing an exhibit list and printing exhibits?
I'd like to just echo what Mr. Upsitnik said a moment ago. Really, is there's while it might be attractive to have sort of an all-in-one tool available to you, trial is stressful enough without introducing these variables. If the trial counsel who had experience with a particular program wanted to go that way, I would encourage them to do that so that they could eliminate that one variable at trial.
Okay. Now I'm going to go into some group questions that came in. In a native file review, how do you restrict access to exec files or others that may damage the data or the machine? And I'm going to give that to, Tom.
I'm sorry, could you please repeat the question?
In a native file review, how do you restrict access to exe files or others that may damage the data or the machine?
Typically, when we're doing putting native review environments up, those types of tools have already been, or types of program files have already been stripped out of the data set. The product, whether you're reviewing in native files or reviewing in an image format such as TIFF, the product that you're preparing is a database that's going to be linked to a view of the document, either the native file or the image. And as such, what we want to do is strip out anything that's a non-document file from the systems in the first place. The other is that we can make the files, in terms of making sure the files aren't being edited during the review process, restrict the files to read-only writes, and so people can't go in and actually modify the documents. But with native file reviews, these things are still fairly new. We're still trying to figure out best practices. And I would like to echo something that was said a little earlier, in that just because you need to produce native files doesn't mean that you need to review native files. Really, the work on how to design your review should be about workflow and throughput and cost management and quality. And just make sure that you have a plan for how you ultimately are going to need to produce those documents if it is in a different format.
Okay, Chris, this one's for you. Once the project has started, what role or actions do you find helpful that a hands-on agency, staffing agency, I think, perform during the document review to ensure a successful project?
Well, it's been my experience that when possible, to have the agency provide the space, the equipment, and the contract attorneys makes it a lot easier to manage than having having disparate sources for all of those resources, and it certainly takes a lot less time for management. So I think that would be the key consideration.
Great. Kevin, I'll give this to you, Jim. Do you recommend second review by client lawyers?
Oh, I wasn't ready for that question, Carl. You're way off the script here. as far as second review, I think if it's, you have to kind of gauge what the client's needs are. I usually did not require it for a lot of our projects, but I think it has to do with kind of the nature of the case. So I think that for that assurance and also for the law firm to feel that they've done their responsibility to the client, I think there has to be a need to go ahead and provide that kind of second-level review as well, yeah.
Okay. I actually think, Tim, you had a question like this. What are the merits of native versus TIFF review? Mr. Opsitnik.
The merits of native versus TIFF review?
Yeah.
It really is. It's a function of, as was earlier outlined, it's a function of your workflow and what your requirements are for production. You need to figure out, how you best want to operate and what you're required to do on your output side and what's the software that you're utilizing, what they're capable of doing. There are some advantages to doing TIFF and producing in TIFF. It provides some consistency in the review. You don't have to worry about bringing up all these native pieces of data and viewing them and installing all sorts of different viewers. If you're only dealing with TIFF, you only have to have TIFF viewers on your software. It's much easier to do redactions in TIFF form. It's much easier to control the production of the TIFF. But then again, on the metadata, as you're well aware, that courts are more and more requiring in specialized sets of circumstances the production in native file because people want to review the metadata. And I do emphasize in special sets of circumstances because I, for one, do not believe that it should be required right out of the box. I think there needs to be some additional showing as to why the metadata is required to increase the burdens on the client if they've got a process set up to produce the documents and review them in TIFF.
Okay. Tim Kuhn, this is for you. Please discuss some proactive approaches to litigation.
Do you have a more narrow question, Carl? Proactive approaches to litigation.
You had some interesting thoughts on how to handle discovery
Just very briefly, and I think it's one of the points that were made that I suggested for the PowerPoint that's accompanying the materials. I'm of the view, and I think from what I hear from other people on this panel, many of them are of the view that the coding team, the reviewing team, should be more than just a sophisticated piece of machinery to send a piece of paper out the door. They are the people who actually review the documents. They're the first ones to see the information, and that structuring the whole project to get value from them reading and analyzing the documents and getting that important information up to the discovery and trial teams. That's I think a proactive approach that one should take in all of these projects.
Okay. Tess, and there are only a couple more. What are the top two e-discovery questions you have asked or received?
Top two. Typically, the first question I get is about price. Why does it cost so much? How can we reduce the costs? The second question is, and I think I alluded to it in one of my top twos, why can't we just open up, Outlook and review all these emails without having to do any electronic discovery processing? Do you want me to answer those questions now?
That wasn't asked, but why not? In 30 seconds. I'm joking.
I can't answer the first one, obviously, what the costs are. I can certainly try to educate the clients and my colleagues with whom I work as to why things cost what they do and what is involved. And I do spend a lot of my time doing that sort of educating. As to what to say in response to an attorney who comes down the hall with a CD full of PSTs and they just want to pop them into their computer and review them and somehow select and produce that way, there are a host of reasons why that's a very bad idea. First of all, there's no control over where the PSTs came from, how you're going to select those for production and those that should be excluded, and I could go on and on. And so those are the top two questions that I get, and my campaign to educate is a way around them.
Carl, can I just add one thing?
Go ahead.
I mean, the whole thing about the cost side is just so critical to these projects. And I know I've developed tools, what I call an e-discovery cost calculator, and really I was almost forced to create something like that. Because when these costs get to be so high, and then your company CFO has to get involved and the like, those type of surprises just can blow up your whole project. So I think we've gotten smarter and smarter. We have more data now that allows us to do some cost calculation by the number of custodians, the number of accounts, the number of servers that we're actually going to have to go ahead and harvest from, that we can come up with some predictability about what the costs are going to be and let the client, I'm talking about the business client, know about that up front during the early case assessment process.
Okay. This is the last question, then I have one last of my own, but and I might just be getting tired, but I can't quite understand this, but so I'm going to give this to Dave Cohen, Harvard lawyer. How influential is the war room provider decision-making of the review tool?
Okay, well, I will take that question to mean how important is what review tool you select to the quality of the review and the ultimate outcome. How about if I answer that one?
Fine.
Well, I think a lot of review tools are similar, and I'm probably going to make enemies among a number of the different companies that offer these tools because they'll all tout the special features of their review tools that they make available either in their software or for their on-site reviews. But I would say that probably 90 to 95% of what you do is using the basic features of the tool, looking at the documents and making decisions on relevance or privilege or issues. They all seem to have those capabilities. And so I think where there may be some differences and a critical element is speed of the review. You don't want your software slowing down how quickly the review can be accomplished. And that's both a function of what software you use and also underlines the importance of setting up your configuration in terms of hardware and network to make sure that you can move at the fastest possible speed in your review. I will say that there are some new tools that in some cases can be very helpful that allow concept searching and that group similar information and allow you to prioritize the review in various ways. And that can be a big time saver where your review is focused on particular issues. Less so when your review is just focused on doing a privilege review and producing what you have to produce to the other side or narrowing that production, because a lot of these concept tools are too complicated to try to explain to a judge or your opposing counsel in a way that they will accept the use of those tools to actually filter what you have to produce to them. So I would say that when you get into preparing your own case and looking at those issues, some of the concept searching tools can add a lot. But for your basic review for production and privilege purposes, you really the big focus should be on speed, because most of the other popular tools contain what you need in terms of features.
Okay, last question. I want to end on a light note, given the subject matter. And, Kevin, I could ask this of anyone on the panel, but I'm going to pick on you. You're both an attorney. You're someone with 20 years of technology operations experience. Do you sometimes feel like the messy world of electronic discovery was created just to give you a perfect-fitting job that very few people can do well?
Well, Carl, I think there's good days and there's bad days. There are some days when I feel that e-discovery is kind of a vindication or validation of the kind of career path that some gals and guys like me have gone down over time. And then there's other days when I walk out of a meet and confer, or I walk out of a review room, and I am firmly convinced that e-discovery is nothing more than karmic payback for some really nasty stuff that we must have done in a previous life. So, it all depends on how things are flowing that day.
Great. Well, obviously we could do this for another 4 or 5 hours. There's plenty of questions we didn't ask, but I think it's, we've gone a couple minutes over. I want to go upstairs and have a glass of wine with the people in Pittsburgh that are listening to this. I don't know if anyone else is supposed to jump on, and I think that you're supposed to do a link with the materials that you got to get your CLE credits. Outside of that, I just want to thank the panel for acting like you're in law school again and just spotting issues like crazy and trying to give out common sense, quick, intelligent answers. You did a great job, and it was a pleasure working with all of you.
Carl, thanks for putting this all together on behalf of everyone here.
Thank you, Carl.
Thank you. Thanks, Carl.
Thanks.
Okay. That's it.
Okay.
Great. And that concludes today's conference call. We thank you for your participation, and have a nice day.